Mary. Third time's a charm. Mary's parents died within 2 months of each other, and it was not until after their death that Mary discovered that her sister, who had power of attorney, had several months earlier transferred the parents' modest estate into her own name, leaving nothing for Mary or for the other siblings. When confronted, the sister said that her parents had treated her unfairly all of her life, and therefore this was owed to her. Mary never brought the subject up again, but privately she grieved for her sister's attitude and conduct, and she prayed that God would forgive her. Contrast that attitude, please, with a startlingly different response as seen in an advertisement in our Denver papers very recently. You may have seen it. It was a very prominently displayed ad, probably 5 or 6 inches by 6 inches. It appeared several times. In it was a picture of Joanne and these words: "As the year 2001 draws to a close, Joanne Justice of Parker announces her divorce from Travis Justice of Larkspur. I am using this unique format to thank all my family and friends for standing by me throughout this ordeal." Which of the two women would you rather have as a neighbor? Can you imagine relationships in which forgiveness and reconciliation were higher values than self-vindication and personal justice? Can you imagine a community in which truly caring for another person was a higher value than personally being treated fairly? The woman who sought God's forgiveness for her thieving sister is unfortunately, to many of us, simply naive. The woman who sought revenge on her ex-husband strikes many of us, at least at first, as something rather funny. Frankly, we live in a world that can identify much more quickly and much more closely with the divorced woman's resentment than with the cheated sister's forgiveness. We've grown accustomed to broken and breaking relationships. We don't like resentment and hostility when they are directed at us, but we can't quite imagine a world without it. We've grown so accustomed to it that we might even think that life would be rather boring without it. It becomes the main fodder for so many of our conversations. We talk about what so-and-so did and how we would like to respond or how we did respond. But Jesus calls us to a wholly different mindset and lifestyle, radically different. Stand with me, please, again, this time in honor of God's word as I read from Matthew chapter 5, beginning at verse 20. "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard that it was said to people long ago, 'Do not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, 'Raca,' is answerable to the Sanhedrin," that's a court. "But anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." You may be seated. So instead of anger and resentment, Jesus calls us to forgiveness and reconciliation. This is a kingdom of heaven lifestyle. The kingdom of heaven. For those of you who did not hear the previous messages in this series, let me just briefly explain the kingdom of heaven. Our text today is taken rather obviously from the Sermon on the Mount, and it is called a sermon for very good reason. It is not simply a collection of unrelated thoughts, but is a very crafted and reasoned whole. You can't properly understand the later portions of the Sermon on the Mount unless you fully understand what Jesus has said at the very beginning. Jesus brought the good news that the kingdom of heaven is near. Now, when he said that, he did not mean that the end of the age had arrived. What he meant was that God's presence and God's authority has become available to all of us. Last week, we looked at it and described it this way. The Bible refers to this age and the age to come. We understand this age to mean the one in which we presently live and all of those who have lived before us. That's the present age. The age to come is the age that will be ushered in when Jesus Christ comes again. We think of this age as the one that is ruled by sin and death, the kingdom of the world. We think of the age to come as the one that is ruled by God, the kingdom of heaven. But what Jesus came announcing was the good news that God's kingdom of heaven has reached back into this age. Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is near. That is, that kingdom, authority, and presence of God is available to us now. And if you trust in Jesus Christ, if you embrace him, it means that you are a part of the kingdom of heaven here and now. There's yet something else that we must bear in mind as we think about these instructions for kingdom living. It is only by grace that we become part of the kingdom of heaven. Only by God's grace that we embrace Jesus Christ and his sufficiency is made for us so that we become Christians, we become part of God's family, we become part of the kingdom of heaven. And it is only by grace that we can live out that kingdom lifestyle to which Jesus here in the Sermon on the Mount calls us. For centuries, people have erroneously believed that if they were good enough, God would find favor with them. They would be acceptable to God. But when we are confronted with the demands of God's holy law, when we see the standard of righteousness that a holy God says is there, we realize how incapable we are of meeting the standard. And we realize that we cannot possibly measure up. On our own, we lack the righteousness. On our own, we lack the goodness to belong to God's kingdom. Jesus came to solve that fatal problem through his death and his resurrection. This is the way God said it in 2 Corinthians 5. God made him, that is Jesus, who had no sin, to be sin for us, so that in Jesus we might become the righteousness of God. Therefore, by trusting in Jesus, we are granted his righteousness. That is, his goodness is given to us, credited to us, so that we are eligible to belong to the kingdom of God. But being granted his goodness and living out his goodness are two different things. Anticipating how it would even be possible for God's kingdom people to live a kingdom lifestyle, the Old Testament prophets said this, Jeremiah 31, "After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts." No longer will the law simply be external, something we look to and try to abide by. It will be written on our very hearts. Ezekiel chapter 36, God said, "And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws." God has promised to change us from the inside. as part of his kingdom then, and made able by his Spirit, Jesus calls us to a whole new way of living. It's kingdom living. And that is what this text that we look at this morning and the rest of the Sermon on the Mount is about. It will show us the awesome possibilities of kingdom living. Now, there's one more important perspective that we must have in order to properly understand what might otherwise be perceived as simply new laws that Jesus sets forth. We must understand who is speaking. These strong words that we will read in the balance of the Sermon on the Mount come from no other than the person Jesus himself. Unless we appreciate that, we will, I'm convinced, never accept these words, and we certainly will never be able to live by them. What Jesus will tell us about kingdom living is not simply a new set of tougher laws by which we can earn his favor. Not at all. The point that he made much earlier in the sermon is that it's by grace, his grace, that he has already accepted us just as we are. We belong to him. We did not earn it by keeping the law. We do not keep it by keeping the law. And so this person, this Jesus who loves us, who has called us to himself by his grace, is the one who says to us, or speaks to us, of the great possibilities of kingdom living. We must understand that the one who is speaking is the one who loves us dearly, and his desire is for our good. As a surgeon must wound us deeply in order to heal us, so Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount may well cut very deeply into us, but they are to heal us. They are to teach us. And so Jesus begins to set forth the great possibilities of kingdom living. And what an amazing life it would be. What an amazing transformation it would make in our relationships if this was the lifestyle of God's kingdom people. I'm indebted to Dallas Willard, whose words I have modified in the slides that you're going to see that give you an overview of the rest of chapter 5 of Matthew. Jesus illustrates kingdom living by citing 6 relational issues. And then he shows the difference between the old way of living and the new way, kingdom way of living. Situation number 1, which we will look at this morning, is simply when we are irritated with others. The old way was simply to say to ourselves, we ought not to murder them. The new way is forgiveness and reconciliation. Situation 2, which we will look at next week, starts in verse 27. The situation is sexual attraction. The old way was simply no intercourse. With Jesus, it is love instead of lust. Situation number 3, verse 31, an unhappy marriage. The old way was divorce. The new way, no divorce. And on the next slide, you can see the other 3 beginning in verse 33 and following. Wanting to be believed is the situation. Being personally injured is the situation. Or having an enemy is the situation. And what Jesus does is he contrasts the old way with the new way. And so we come back to the first of Jesus' illustrations of the greater righteousness of kingdom living. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Jesus here is not arguing with the Mosaic law. Neither is Jesus arguing with the interpretation of the Mosaic law, at least as far as that interpretation goes. Jesus is simply saying the interpretation doesn't go far enough. We knew that we were not supposed to murder. But Jesus says it is much, much deeper than that. We aren't even supposed to carry resentment toward another. And lest we misunderstand how serious Jesus is about this, please notice he uses the same phrase to speak of the consequence of murder as he does the consequence of anger. That is, they are both subject to judgment. We don't believe that, do we? In our thinking, we have created something of a hierarchy of sins. Some, we believe, are clearly more wrong. For example, murder. Some, we believe, are not so bad. For example, a little resentment. But Jesus says resentment is absolutely contrary to a kingdom attitude. And he calls us to a radically different lifestyle and attitude. But before talking about that radically different attitude, I want you first of all to let Jesus' judgment on anger sink in. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Anger is subject to God's judgment. Now, anger, at least initially, can serve a very important function in our lives. It is a feeling that wells up within us when we feel that something or someone is threatening us. Like pain, anger alerts us to a potential threat. In the case of pain, it is, in fact, an alert that our physical bodies are being threatened. When it comes to anger, however, it's a threat against my will. Something or someone is getting in the way of what I want. And it's what we do with the anger that is aroused by that perceived threat that is the problem. If we indulge it, it grows. It's like fertilizing a tomato plant. We may not act on it immediately, but it builds within us, especially over time. The word angry is a word that carries the connotation of an orgy of feelings. Another connotation is of a temporary madness. Interesting, isn't it, that that's in fact the very synonym that we often use for our anger. We are mad at someone. The word carries the idea of a continuing attitude, is being angry, bears anger, carries anger, nurses a grudge, a continuing anger, a prolonged, carried around kind of anger. Emil Brunner wrote, "It is this attitude of carried anger that Jesus confronts with judgment. This attitude must go. And this attitude is not just an attitude or an inner matter. It is not just an emotion that is not yet a deed. This carrying around of anger presupposes a decision to carry it, and such a decision constitutes a deed, a decision for a way to live." Anger can be almost totally hidden, as in a slow burning resentment towards someone, or it can be very visible in an all-out search to somehow retaliate, to somehow inflict at least emotional harm. You can watch it with older children in its rawest forms. The difference between them and us is that we, most of us, have learned how to be much more sophisticated in our anger. But it's still the same. My ego has been wounded. I consider myself to have been unjustly treated. We even get angry when all we know is that someone else is angry with us, even if we don't know what it's for. Our egos are so fragile. Willard wrote, "All our mental and emotional resources are marshaled to nurture and tend the anger. Energy is dedicated to keeping it alive. We constantly remind ourselves of how wrongly we have been treated. And when it is allowed to govern our actions, its evil is quickly multiplied in heart-rending consequences and in the replication of anger and rage in the hearts and bodies of everyone it touches." Jesus goes on to drive home his point in the rest of verse 22. Again, anyone who says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin, a court. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. I do not believe that there's some kind of gradation given here by Jesus. I think he is simply using repetition and variation to draw out the point that he's trying to make. And like most kids, I was so woodenly literal in my understanding of Scripture that as a child I thought that if I merely said the words, you fool, to my brother, I would go to hell. I thought there was something inherent in the words, or especially in that word, fool. That saying it meant you didn't go pass go, you didn't collect $200, you just went right straight to the eternal jail. Well, we aren't even certain what the word raca means, except that in the context, both here and other places, it is obviously derisive. Together with the fool, the word fool, it indicates an insulting contempt for another person. The problem, you see, is not so much in the word. It's in the heart. The words of contempt only express the boiling over of the heart. So Jesus' interpretation of the law goes beyond protecting the physical life. Jesus goes to protecting the person. God judges words. God judges resentment that takes away from another person's honor. In kingdom living, every person is made in the image of God and is worthy of our love. And God is deadly serious about this. For in these verses, he says that anger, resentment, and contempt are subject to judgment and the court and the fire of hell. As I said a minute ago, I think the repetition is simply, the variation is simply a way of repeating and driving home the point that active disregard of another person is unacceptable in the kingdom of heaven. As I said last week, grace doesn't mean that obedience doesn't matter. Again, Emil Brunner, we do not do the master of love any honor by omitting references to judgment. The holiness of God is at war with all bitterness and hatred and hurting. And where his holiness collides with our hostility, the crash is called the wrath of God. God's wrath is God's war of love against everything that unnecessarily hurts others. The wrath of God is the proof of the love of God. Chrysostom wrote, "It is love that warns of hell." Well, back to the question that I had as a child, does it mean that if I harbor anger towards someone that I'm going to hell? Please hear this very, very carefully. Without intervention, it would mean exactly that. Without intervention, it would mean exactly that. That's how serious God is about his kingdom people, his kingdom, and kingdom living. It's wholly inconsistent with a kingdom lifestyle. Nothing but the death of Jesus Christ is sufficient to mitigate the divine penalty against that sin of anger and resentment. Please, in your thinking about the sins for which Christ died, do not make them so abstract by referring to them only as Jesus dying for the sins of the world. Make it very personal. My sins and my sin of anger against, and name the name. Amazing love. How can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? Died he for me who caused his pain, for me who him to death pursued. If what Jesus said is true, then his words, these hard words, I think drive us to despair of ourselves, both for our liability to judgment and for our inability, our helplessness to be any different. When I hear these words of Jesus, I recognize both things afresh. One, how deserving of God's judgment my attitudes have been, and how helpless I am to do anything about it, to change it on my own. And it is that recognition of sin that drives us to grace. That's what the Old Testament law does, and I'm convinced that's what the New Testament Sermon on the Mount does. It drives us to grace. I stand forgiven, not because I deserve it, but solely because Jesus died in my place. And I am called to a whole new way of treating others by the same grace that has been shown to me. For it is God at work in me, both giving me the will to be different and the ability to do so. Look at Paul saying it in Philippians chapter 2. Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good pleasure. And so by God's grace working in us, we choose to forgive instead of being angry. By God's grace working in us, we choose to forgive instead of resenting. Crying out for God's help and recognizing we are fully dependent on Him, we make the choice and we keep making the choice. And we act out that choice by refusing to think the things we formerly thought, by refusing to say the things we have formerly said, by refusing to act in the ways we formerly acted. That is forgiveness. That's a kingdom lifestyle. Marietta Jager's 7-year-old daughter was kidnapped from their tent during a camping trip in the state of Montana. When it happened, Marietta's first response was one of intense rage. She wrote, "I was seething with hate, ravaged with a desire for revenge. I said to my husband, and I meant it with every fiber of my being, even if Susie is brought back alive and well this minute, I could kill this man for what he has done to our family." But Marietta soon realized that no amount of anger could bring her daughter back. She wasn't ready yet to forgive her daughter's kidnapper, but she wrestled hard with God. And she finally surrendered, and deep down inside she sensed that forgiving was the only way that she could possibly cope with her loss. And so she began to pray for her daughter's kidnapper. And over the months, it became easier and easier. Exactly 1 year, she writes, to the minute, 1 year after the kidnapping, she received a phone call, and it was the kidnapper. The man's voice was smug and taunting. She said, "I was surprised at the genuine feeling of compassion I had for that man." And it was yet months before the man was apprehended and Susie's body was found. But Marietta writes, "By then I had finally come to learn that Jesus did not come to hurt, but to reconcile." That is a kingdom of heaven attitude, possible only by grace, but possible by grace. Only possible by grace, but possible by God's grace. Again from Brunner, "It's important to know first that we do break God's commands so that we will be disabused of self-righteousness. But it is just as important that we know that we can keep God's commands, at least retroactively, by immediately seeking reconciliation with those whom we have hurt. Jesus is not content with just showing us up and bringing us down. He concludes his command by teaching us what to do when we go wrong." And so kingdom living calls not only for forgiveness for those who have offended us, But kingdom living also calls for reconciliation with those we have hurt. Look at Jesus. The next verse is in Matthew 5. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar first. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Jesus here gives no indication of whether it was actually something we did or not that caused the offense. What caused the offense is not even in view here. It is just that something is wrong. Jesus implies that even if you are in the right, even if you are the injured party, a kingdom lifestyle calls for you taking the initiative for reconciliation. In fact, Jesus says reconciliation is a higher priority than worship. All the religious activity in the world does not negate the command to reconcile. All the worship, all the prayers, all the Bible reading, all the good things we might try to do, all the efforts we make, do not in any way take away from this command to be reconciled. Psalm chapter 66, if I had cherished sin in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. As one author put it, the Lord does not want to talk with a disciple who does not want to talk with a brother or a sister. That's a pretty sharp statement. What if the offended person won't forgive me? Well, that's her concern with God. I am only responsible for me and my attitude. Am I willing? And will I continue to be willing to reconcile? Nobody is written off in the kingdom of heaven. Nobody. It wasn't until later that I realized it for what it was. I was angry. In fact, I was intensely angry. My anger usually only shows itself in very civilized, controlled ways. I don't rant or rave or break things. I'm one of those who simply gets quiet, maybe very quiet. A man who had been a very good friend for a number of years began to actively slander me. He sought out people to tell what he felt I had done to hurt him and his family. I knew that the things that he was saying were absolutely not true. His actions and his words began to come back to me from enough sources that I began to respond to it, and I realized that I needed to do something about it, so I went to him to apologize for the hurt that I had caused and said that I had certainly not meant in any way to hurt him. But I received from him only a very angry response and an absolute unwillingness to reconcile. It was not long after that that he left the church. But he kept saying the same angry, slanderous things against me, even misrepresenting my attempt at reconciliation. And this time, when I heard it, I became mad. Yes, I'm using the word the way the Greek indicates it. It just became an orgy of feelings. I remember so wrongly thinking to myself, I maybe had to put up with this when he was in this church, but so help me now that he's gone, I don't have to let him get by with this ever again. And for days, I seethed about what was going on. I couldn't help but thinking about it. In fact, so much so that I realized at one point that my attitudes or this very man's presence was absolutely controlling my life. I imagined all kinds of things that I would say to him to make him realize how wrong he had been, to make him, to actually give him a bit of his own medicine. And finally, after seething about it for some days, I made the phone call. And in that phone call, I let him have it. I didn't let him get a word in edgewise. And finally, I told him that if he did not cease and desist, I was going to call the pastor of his new church and let him and others know exactly what this man has been up to, and I hung up the phone. It felt great. As some of you know, it felt great for about 30 seconds. And then God's Holy Spirit began to go to work. I wrestled with God for a couple of days before I finally called the man again and asked if I could come to see him. Surprisingly, he said I could. I wrestled with God all the way there about what that apology needed to look like. I wanted so desperately to drag up all of the past, not just the phone call. But I realized I had to stick with that, and I apologized fully, no excuses. Apologized for the way that I had treated him, how wrong it had been. He listened to me very politely, and then with an edge in his voice, he simply said, "It's about time you came." And I almost lost it again. And I would have. Something inside of me wanted to just drag everything back up and go after him one more time in no uncertain terms. But on the way there, God had reminded me from his word that my responsibility was for my actions, not for the other man's. He was God's business, not mine. I have continued to hold out an olive branch to that man through the past couple of years, but as of yet, he has not responded. But that, too, is God's business. The possibilities of kingdom living are so much greater than merely obeying the letter of the law. And it finally comes down to a decision. Do I want to live a kingdom lifestyle? Do I want to be God's kingdom person, forgiving and reconciling? Am I willing to be that kind of person? No sermon, no preacher can make you want to live that way. Only grace can do that. Only grace can help you recall the forgiveness for your own sins. And only grace can give you the grace to live toward others that way. The king's laws drive us to grace. And then grace calls us to the king's laws. Please don't attempt to live by the king's laws if you don't have the king's heart. I close with Oswald Chambers. The test Jesus gives is not just to determine the truth of our manner, but the temper of our mind. Many of us are wonderfully truthful in manner, but our temper of mind is rotten in God's sight. What Jesus alters is the temper of mind. We have to fulfill the law, and the only way it can be done is by letting Jesus alter us within, and by remembering that everything he tells us to do, we can do. The whole point of our Lord's teaching is, obey me, and you will find you have a wealth of power within. God's kingdom people, living a kingdom lifestyle by his grace. Stand with me, please, in prayer.